Came from nowhere to St. Francis Street. Jukebox baby, I played a little bit. Cadillac came, watch for the heat. Jukebox baby. Little lady says my name. Jukebox baby, playing a strange game. Blind trumpet player, looking for fame. Jukebox baby. Coming home, that's where I stay. Jukebox baby, playing Johnny Rep. Hotshot gambler, looking for play. Jukebox baby. Electron woman, jukebox baby, playing number four. Avenging angel, defeating the poor. Jukebox baby. Little alien, get yourself a gun. Jukebox baby, play a little fun. American soldiers are on the run. Jukebox baby. Come to hotels in full truth. Jukebox baby, playing pure heat. Line on clear, selling all for me.
Vega and Jukebox Baby. Best known for co-founding the early punk duo Suicide, Alan lived a complex and labyrinthine life driven by desire to express himself uncompromisingly through art. From his first sketch in an art class at Brooklyn College to the release in 2021 of the album Mutator, 5 years after his death. Vega continues to shock and inspire. This is the first ever biography of Vega, telling the story of the man's art. It is by Laura Davis-Shannon. It's called Infinite Dreams, The Life of Alan Vega. Delighted to say that Laura joins us live on the line now. Laura, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Jeff. How you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. Not too bad at all. He's an important figure. He is influential in an awful lot of what happens with the synth scene, say, of the 80s that follows him. He is an integral part of the New York art scene, but yet very few people, perhaps, have more than a passing knowledge, if even that.
Well, I have to say, yeah, I mean, he had a huge effect on people in the industry. That's kind of where the largest effect was. Although he was Jukebox Baby, and a lot of other of his works became very big in Europe. He was very big in Europe, as a musician and an artist. He just had a big show in Paris at the, I forget which gallery it was, but just a couple of weeks ago. So anyway, yeah, he was a real enigma. And how I got involved was that when I was in the 70s rock scene and I had my own band called the Student Teachers, we opened for Suicide a number of times, as did many bands at that time. And in New York City, this is in New York City at Max's Kansas City and CBGB's and places like that. And I remember every time I finished my set, I would watch Suicide and I would go, what the hell? I could not get this. I was like, whoa, this is not rock and roll. What is this? And then I learned over time. Oops, sorry. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. No worries.
Okay. I'm sorry. And then I learned over time how important their music was, Suicide, because it was Alan Vega and Marty Rev, and the effect that it had on really phenomenal effect. But again, I don't know if you're aware of The Theater of Cruelty by Antonin Artaud, but that was a really very key point, which was The Theater of Cruelty. Oops, sorry. One moment.
No problem at all.
I keep losing myself here.
Well, welcome to my world.
The Theater of Cruelty. The Theater of Cruelty was all about that performance in theater is not about entertainment. It's not about enjoying and having fun. It's about learning and becoming aware of the damage of the world around you. And at the time that Suicide started, it was just after the Vietnam War was finished, and the state of New York City was just a disaster. Having been there, I know, because I grew up there. That's a lot of why Alan Vega and Marty Rev and Suicide behaved the way they were. Of note, the name Suicide. Oh my God, what hell of a name is that for a band? How are you going to? Well, that was not a comment on the unfortunate, knowledge we have about suicide, but rather a reflection of his disgust of America on American society and what they had done in Vietnam and what they were doing, in New York City. Anyway. I know that's I'm taking up too much time about that, but anyway, yeah. And so then over the course of the next 30 years, he went on and did a lot of solo work, really incredible solo work. He was on Elektra Records and he just did phenomenal stuff. His heart was in rhythm and blues, and you see that in his solo stuff more than in the stuff with Suicide. But as I say, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Idol, Elvis Costello, these people just were amazed by him, particularly Bruce, who plays Dream Baby Dream, one of Alan's songs, every single concert. It's his last song that he plays, Dream Baby Dream. And that's the thing, is he had a real effect on people in the industry. And I think part of it was that he was not playing into the sort of expected dynamic or expected kind of thing that you would see them people do on stage in rock and roll. You know, he defied it.
I mean, this is the thing, because when you said you went, what is this, Seeing Suicide? And that's a great name, by the way, for a support band. The Student Teachers, was it that you said?
Yeah, my band was called The Student Teachers.
So
yeah.
it's
I was the drummer.
Yeah, it's night. So what is it, 1970, 75, 76, 77?
I would say 70, 77, 78, 79.
Right, so New York is a dangerous place to be at that point. The city is falling apart. Yeah. You've got punk, you've got new wave, and it's an interesting time to because they were confrontational, weren't they? I mean, they were. You mentioned the theater of cruelty. It is that we're not going to see David Gates and the Sound of Bread. We're going to go in, and you know, it's not Southern California. This is harsh. This is New York with rats as big as cats, etc. And we are going to upset you in the way that say the MC5 had done 5 years before or 6 years before in Detroit. So yeah.
Well, even Iggy Pop had done 5, 6 years before, which is actually Iggy Pop was Alan's inspiration to go into music. At the time, he was just working in visual art. But I have to say, like, for instance, he was in, I think it was Brussels, and he was opening for Elvis Costello. And this was in 78, I think, 79. And The people hated Suicide so much because they were opening for Elvis, who was new on the scene, big time, you know, and the audience were throwing things. I mean, literally, I'm talking like bottles and screwdrivers and all kinds of crap at them.
And this is the Belgians, who are not known for getting excited about many things anyway, you know?
Yeah, I know. Anyway, and it got so chaotic that the police were called. And so that became a big deal, you know, and Alan and Marty had to, you know, escape out the backstage. But that was not unusual. That happened a lot. In fact, he's lucky to have never gotten anything seriously awful done to him. He did experience a screwdriver or maybe a knife that hit him right next to his eye. But thank God it didn't hit his eye. This is among the many times that all of this happened at these concerts. That was playing into his deep, profound belief about the whole point, which is that I'm not here to give you fun. You're not here to have fun. This is not entertainment. I am here to show you the world as it really is and that you're trying to avoid. And, that was really his point. I want to say that kind of started to change after Suicide, you know, ended and Alan went to do his thing and yeah. Marty went to do his thing. Also, Rick Ocasek from the Cars was a huge, huge adorer of Suicide and Alan Vega. And he produced most of Alan's early albums and worked with Alan for years. I mean, they were, I would have to say, really brothers. Ultimately, I mean, he was hanging out at Rick's house and they'd be in his studio doing all kinds of stuff. So that was another major artist that was incredibly, amazed by Alan Vega. And I think the thing, as you will see when you read the book, which I hope you do, because I think you'll really be fascinated at where did this guy come from? I write all about where he came from, his life in Brooklyn, growing up and what happened as a young man, his early marriage, why he left Brooklyn, came to Manhattan. It's just fascinating the way it all evolved. Now, a part of that also is that he was a very prolific visual artist. And the fascinating thing to see is the kind of visual art he was doing. In the beginning, he was going out into the streets and picking up garbage and creating these sculptures out of garbage from the street. And I think that this was, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, when there was a massive ton of garbage in the streets of New York. And that's what he was building his sculptures out of. But then he got very involved in light, how light works with art. And it just became very interesting. My point, I really feel that as he moved on in terms of music and got into his solo stuff, more of his rhythm and blues love came in. and it became different, but still really interesting and fascinating. He, one of his best fabulous albums is Cubist Blues, which he made with Ben Vaughan. And I just love that album. But anyway, I suggest that you check them all out.
Indeed. I'm just thinking about, because people would go, oh, the Cars. That's, you know, that's Heartbreak City. That's all sort of friendly MTV pop. But, you know, if you go back to the Cars in the late 70s, they were raw. I mean, they were proper sort of new wave.
Yeah, they were.
And a lot of people and a lot of bands sort of got that MTV thing. Alan didn't, because he is an artist. He is, you know, he is an artist, therefore, in the same way.
Well, let me just say.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Okay. They were on, oh, God, my brain is not working now because I can't remember the name, but there was this show that was done by this very famous guy whose name I forgot, a television show. And the Cars were on this television show, and they wanted Suicide to open for them. And there was a lot of backlash. No, no, no. And then Rick Ocasek said, either Suicide opens for us on this TV show or we're not doing it. And it was a very famous old show that I'm sorry, I can't remember.
Letterman, perhaps?
But, pardon me?
What, Letterman? David Letterman?
No. It was Carson. Midnight. It was a music show with Wolfgang.
Oh.
You remember his name?
I
can't remember.
Wolfgang, yeah, I know the word, yeah. Anyway, Wolf Dreiser.
Anyway, but my point is that Rick Ocasek was like, they opened for the Cars at the LA Amphitheater in the 1980, I think it was. I mean, an LA Amphitheater. I mean, can you believe it? Suicide, two guys standing there playing their unusual, you know, fascinating stuff. Before the Cars, it was just amazing the things that Rick Ocasek got them to do, and it was quite remarkable and it's just amazing.
Tell me about we mentioned Iggy a little bit, but it is meeting Iggy in '69 when, you know, Iggy is just the Stooges are going pretty strong. They're just starting this ride, aren't they? At least Iggy is.
Yeah, well, Iggy and the Stooges. Yeah, they were playing in '69 and. That was actually the show in Queens, New York, was where Alan first saw him. And this was the show that just said to him, I've got to go into this. And what Iggy did at that time, and he's done variations over the years, was that he would take his clothes, he would be undressing on stage. He would be, you know, lying down on stage. He'd be grabbing the microphone and throwing it. I mean, that was kind of where, you know, Alan wanted to go. He was really inspired by that because that spoke to the theater of cruelty, you know, idea.
And having seen Iggy play Marbella last year, he's still doing that. He is still absolutely uncompromising in his art.
Yeah, well, he's quite remarkable. But the other thing that I didn't mention, but I wanted to mention, was that there was a time when Alan saw people, I think it was just before he came on stage once, and he saw people outside in the audience dancing to one of his songs. And he just flipped. And he said to Marty, what the hell have we done? This is terrible. He was really, really upset about that because that wasn't his point. His point was not to have people dancing and enjoying themselves. You know, that was not the kind of music or songs he was writing. He was writing, and I don't even want to say he was writing to teach you anything, but in a way he was, because he was wanting to show you things that you don't want to look at, you know? Anyway. I found that to be fascinating too. And as I say, Bruce Springsteen, who I had a lovely discussion with, he is just so enamored of Alan. And he said in our conversation, he said, you know, Alan Vega's music will be here forever. And I said to him, oh, and yours won't. I was like, what are you, crazy? But he really has that. He just thinks he's amazing.
How important do you think it is? Because you say he freaks out when he sees people dancing through his music, and you see a lot of people in the 80s become MTV friendly and they lose the wild man of rock reputations. But obviously Alan doesn't. How important do you think it is for an artist then to keep, because he is successful in his own way, to keep true to that aim, to not go out to be, you know, I mean, he's not doing dancing in the street with Bowie and Jagger, for example. He keeps on message the whole way through his career, his life.
Well, I think that's a lot of what Bruce and Billy Idol and they all sort of sensed from Alan, was that he was uncompromising and he was just brutally true to himself and his art. And I think anybody who is an artist in any realm, you know, music, art, I mean, visual art, writing, whatever, your goal is to stick with the way you do things, your belief, the meaning of it all, but it can very easily get thrown to the side. It can very easily get thrown to the side because there are so many things going on in terms of commercialism and making money and all kinds of things that can come in and change that and affect you. So it was, I think, one of the things that was quite wonderful for Bruce and all the people and who are inspired by him was Alan didn't care. He just was going to do what he was going to do. I mean, he lived a lot on the streets early on when he first went to New York City. And I mean, he was fine. I say that at the end of the book, I have a quote where he said that he could live on the Bowery, just on the streets. I'd be happy. And it's true.
How approachable, because obviously you met him, you knew him over the years. How approachable was he? Because obviously Lou Reed famously didn't suffer fools. I can imagine Iggy game on a wrong day can be quite a handful. And for those people who don't smooth and play the game and glad hand, was he approachable? Did you have to be on your guard? Or was there no BS, basically?
What do you think?
I'm going for the latter, but you never know. I mean, he could have had a collection of Cabbage Patch Dolls somewhere. I don't know. That's why.
All right. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Honestly, this is the truth. I spoke with probably 50 people in writing this book. 40 of them people we worked with over the years, some of whom I mentioned. Every single one of them said that he was the sweetest, kindest, most generous person they ever knew. He was the exact opposite of what you would think, given what you see in his visual art and his music. And it's just incredible. It's just incredible. I met him, yes, a couple of times because, as I say, my band opened, and he was very sweet and very like, oh, I love you. I mean, you know, very sweet guy. But, it didn't go much further than that. But all these people I spoke with said, if you were attacked and fell on the ground, Alan would be down there helping you, making sure you're okay, getting whatever, what I'm saying? He's that kind of guy. He was that kind of guy. Just incredible.
And also incredible. The fact that you got 50 people to speak about him and they were happy to speak about him rather than going, not that so-and-so, they wanted to talk about him.
Incredible. The amount that they wanted to talk. Wow. Incredible. So, I mean, I was very, very moved by the energy and the love that was coming from all of these people. And, when I was that age and I was playing in those gigs and, he was around and we were opening for him, not in a million years did I ever expect that I would know him the way I know him now, and what I've learned. And I have to say, it's just been very moving and very inspiring for me. It's incredible the amount of things that he's done and how beautiful.
What do you hope that people will learn or take or understand from the book?
Well, obviously the primary thing is I hope that people will see what a lovely, beautiful man he was. And that, and it kind of plays into that concept of the theater of cruelty, but, you know, maybe a little bit adjusted, you know, what he was trying to do and what he was trying to create, you know, reflected something inside him, obviously, and as for all artists, but, he was still just an incredibly giving man. At the end of his life, he drew a string of drawings, sketches called spirit paintings. And they are these images. They are these, you know, of heads, people, but no face. They had no face. And this was everything he did about within the 6 months prior to his death. He drew these incredible sketches. That says a lot. I mean, think about it. Think about what that says as an image in and of itself, a head without a face. It makes you really think. And here it is coming from this incredible, sweet, kind, caring man. He defies, he defies common sense.
The book is called Infinite Dreams, The Life of Alan Vega. It's by Laura Davis-Channon, who is speaking to you today. Can people find you online? Is there a website? Where's the best place to find out more about the process or about him himself?
I would look on... that's very good. I got to start getting that because let me just add to this. It's written by me and his wife,
right,
Liz Lemery. And I just want to say his wife... for many years, worked with him and composed with him and performed with him. And she is now performing. I'm just getting all these texts from her just now. I just noticed. she performs. She's just put out two albums and just they're beautiful. They're incredible. So she's obviously we worked on this together. But on Facebook, there is an Alan Vega site on Facebook that is very, you know, encompassing and very covers everything.
So go check it out. And I'm sure it will be added to in the next few days as this has been a bit of a pointer. You will be able to order the book as well via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Infinite Dreams, The Life of Alan. The Infinite Dreams, The Life of Alan Vega. It's by Laura Davis-Channon. Laura, thank you so much for your time today.